All right, we're going to go ahead and get started in here. We're going to start with a little bit of geography. I don't know about you, but whenever you're reading through the Bible and they mention names of places and that kind of stuff, it's sort of like, you know, that doesn't really mean anything to you unless you've seen it on the map. You kind of know where it is, and we'll be mentioning a few places tonight in our comings and goings through 2 Samuel. The places of note for this evening are going to be Mahanaim, right here. I don't want to shine a light in your face. That'd be bad. So this right here, just remember where we are in the story. So we talked about, you know, 1 Samuel being transition. 2 Samuel is supposed to be all about David. And when we're transitioning from one dynasty to the other dynasty, we're transitioning from Saul's lineage to David's lineage. And there is this last vestige of Saul's lineage that's kind of trying to hang on to the Saul dynasty. And so there's a divided Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, is kind of, the kingdom is sort of divided. We have Judah in the south and the other tribes, Israel in the north. Sounds familiar, like right? We've heard that before. So that's what's happening. So this is where Ish-bosheth is right now. Okay, that's his capital in the north. And this is where David is with his band of mighty men and those who are supporting David, who is the anointed of the Lord, who should be the king right now. And so that is where he is. Now, we mentioned last Wednesday where they had that fight in the Gibeon area, where the one guy got a spear shaft through his belly and out his back with the blunt end of the spear, which, you know, if you had to choose between each one, I would choose a sharp end. But that was right here in this area. So David's men came up here, and Ish-bosheth's men came down here, and that's where they had that fight, that altercation. Now, we're going to mention another situation, a certain desert area tonight that is north of the Dead Sea, the Arabah area, which is right here in this area. This is just a wilderness desert area. The only reason that maybe famous Decapolis is kind of in that area, the Ten Cities area during the time of the Romans. If you've ever watched Indiana Jones, and there's the Valley of the Shadow of the Moon or whatever, remember when they had to go to that temple and choose wisely on the which was the Holy Grail? Any of you ringing any bells? Okay, so that palace or that place they went where they filmed that is right there in this area. In this area as well. So we're going to be talking about that when we get closer in chapter 4. So anyway, just to give you an idea of the areas we're talking about tonight, so that when we do mention them, you'll say, okay, I know where that is. I know about where that is in Israel's geography. So let's fast forward to chapter 3, as we're looking at. Chapter 3 starts off with this phrase. Now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. How long? We don't really know exactly the time period, but it wasn't short. So there was this war between the house of David and the house of Saul. And what are they fighting over? Do you remember? What are they fighting over? What are they fighting for? The kingdom. The kingdom, right? They're fighting over the kingdom. So Ish-bosheth says it's mine. David says, "Well, God said it's mine," and it's a house divided. So, we talked about a famous character, and he's going to come up again, and that is Abner, is going to play a big part in what's going to happen in this chapter. And so, there was this long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker continually. So, what's happening between these two houses? You have these two houses, you have these two groups. The house of David continues to grow, and the house of Saul continues to diminish. If you're in the house of Saul, can you see the writing on the wall? things aren't going to go well. Like, it's coming to an, it's winding down, right? And so everybody kind of in that household is getting that idea. Now, we have this interesting note here in the first few verses, verses 2 and through 4. We have this rundown of David's sons, what sons David has. And they give the son and the wife to whom that he had this son with. And he mentions several. He mentions Anoim, the Jezreelitess, as far as one of his wives. And then he mentions Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And then he mentions his son Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. What's interesting, what is of note that this wife is the daughter of the king of Geshur? Why is that something that might prick our interest? Well, she's a princess. Maybe she was pretty. Disney had nothing to do with this one, right? But yes, who were they supposed to marry? Deuteronomy 7, verse 3, they were supposed to marry Jews. Like, Jews marry Jews. That's how it was supposed to, that's how they were supposed to do. God said specifically, you're supposed to marry them, because if you marry outside of the house of Judah, if you marry outside of Israel, they will lead your hearts away to worship idols and that kind of stuff. So David, if you look through this list, and some of you are reading your head like good students, and reading these few verses, how many wives does he mention? There are six wives here. I'm not going to comment on whether that's prudent or not, but what may not be prudent is marrying outside the lineage of Judah. Who are these people? In Joshua 13:13 talks about these groups of people, that this was a group of people who was in the land of Canaan when they came in to expel them, to eradicate the Canaanites. And this is a group of people that they could not expel. It wasn't that God didn't allow them to do that. It's that the circumstances were that they could not expel this group of people. And so they kind of intermarried into the Israelites. And it's going to cause problems for David later on. This guy Absalom is going to cause problems for David later on in this book, and we'll see why it wasn't prudent. So a little bit of foreshadowing, if you want to put a mental note there, with this son and this wife, there is going to be some issues. But we see here David had six wives at this point, and the sons that he had with those wives. Verse 6, we start this section where we begin to see not necessarily some treason, but some people deciding that it's better for the kingdom if we make peace. And so in verse 6, it came about while they were there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Abner was coming up. Remember, Abner was a cousin to Saul, right? This is a family member, and he's making himself strong in this family. And Ishbosheth says to him, after he finds out that he had relations with one of Saul's concubines, Ishbosheth says, you can't say that real fast, why have you gone into my father's concubine? Do you think he cared about what his cousin or uncle was doing on the side? Do you think he cared about that? Why would he care about this happening? What do you think? Seems kind of random, right, that he would care that he went into his father's concubine. This is a power play, is what this is. This is a power play. And we'll see this again later on in 2 Samuel. But this is, as he's growing up, as Abner is coming up in rank, or coming up in power, at least in the house of Saul, this is a power play. And so this is why Ishbosheth calls him out on it. This is why Ishbosheth says, because now that he's done this with the wives or one of the concubines of Saul, he can lay claim to more power, more authority in that culture. It's not something that we would even recognize or even care about. We might say, ooh, or something like that. But it's not anything that we would recognize as being important. But at that time, this was a power play on behalf of Abner. Abner, we're going to see, as this chapter unfolds, Abner's trying to make peace. He's trying to make things kind of copacetic again and get back the way God wants it to be. And so we're going to see how this plays out. And so he basically fusses at Ishbosheth at this point. Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. And yet today you charge me with guilt concerning the woman." So it's basically saying, I've done well to protect you and not give you over to David and not deceive you and make that happen. Why are you treating me like this? And so he makes this comment in verse 9, "May God do so to Abner, to himself, and more also if I don't accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul to establish the throne of David over Israel, over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba." And so he makes this comment to Ishbosheth, "We need to do this thing. We need to transfer the kingdom from Saul, from you, Ishbosheth, over to David. This is what God has ordained. This is what God wants. This is what's going to bring peace to Israel." Now he says, "from Dan to Beersheba." Do you remember what that means whenever you mention Dan to Beersheba?
North to south.
North to south, right? What do we say here in the States? From New York to LA, from sea to shining sea, right? We sing a song about that. So that's that kind of geographical comment, right? We're talking about all of what God has blessed Israel with, all of Canaan, that's where David should be ruling. And that's what Abner is saying to Ishbosheth. And basically, verse 11 says Ishbosheth could not respond. He had no response. He was verklempt. He had no response. And so Abner sent messengers to David in verse 12, saying, whose is the land? Basically, it's yours. Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you and bring all of Israel over to you. So Abner's making this peace. What do we see Abner trying to do? We're trying to get Israel back to play together again, to play nice with each other, and be one kingdom like they're supposed to. And so he reaches out to David to do that. Listen to what David said. Verse 13, "Good. I will make a covenant with you." Had Abner done anything to David that would cause him to think otherwise about this? Relationship-wise. Were they BFF in the past? Yes, and we'll get there in just a second. Exactly right. Now, Abner was the commander of Saul's army. And Saul was the guy that was chasing David all over the place, right? And so he kind of had a hand in the persecution that David received. Okay, so he sort of had a hand in that, Abner did. But David is here not holding a grudge. David is not. David wants what's best. Obviously, it's going to go well for him if the kingdom comes back together. But he could have said, he could have responded in a different way. But he responded as though he was waiting for this, right? He responded as though he was waiting for this. Good, but here's what he says. "But I demand one thing of you, namely, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see me." Who is this person? Saul's daughter. Yes, his first wife. Now, this is the lady that he fought for, right? This is a lady, Michal, trying to fancy that up. It's Michal, basically, is how it's pronounced. What act did he do to basically win her, not her affections, but to win her hand from the father? Do you remember? Yeah, the debt was 100 foreskins, right? And he went double. He doubled that. And we talked about whether or not it was a situation where he just thought Saul was going to change the number on him, or he wanted to show how the worth or the affection he had for her. We don't know. It's more romantic to say he did it because he, you know, thought that much of her. What a gift, right? So But it is said, if you look over in 1 Samuel, in 1 Samuel 18, let's skip back. Let's go back. 1 Samuel 18, verse 20. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. So we get this commentary. Even the writer of this book knows that she loved David. And so it wasn't one-sided in that relationship. Right? It wasn't one-sided. And then when he fled because of persecution, he was given over, or she was given over to somebody else. In 1 Samuel 25:44, she was giving over to another guy to be Paltiel's wife. And so David sent messengers, and that's exactly what happened. David received her back. Beginning in verse 14 of 2 Samuel chapter 3, so David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife, Michal, to whom I was betrothed, for 100 foreskins for the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from the son of Laish. But her husband went with her weeping. So, you know, he loved her. Yes, sir.
Am I thinking about my first
name? Yes, I can't think of that offhand. Yeah, well, she helped him escape persecution. Early on, she did, yes. And I have to go back and look at that. If you want to Google search that real quick. Okay. So this in this situation, he's wanting her back. Now, if you want the movie version, maybe this is a romantic, "I want her back, I've always loved her," and, you know, that kind of stuff. But if you're looking at it politically, what are we looking at here? She is Saul's daughter, right? What are you trying to do with the supporters of Saul? You're trying to annex them into. So would it be convenient to ask for her back? Of course, it would be convenient to ask for her back. What's that? Yeah, this guy who was not supposed to have her to begin with is acting like a crybaby. David, I mean, the first time, you know, that the Abner kind of comes to him and extends the olive branch, that's the first thing that David asks for, is for this wife to come back. It may be that he always wanted her back. It may be he still is upset about that. He could have held a grudge, obviously. It was not right what Saul did in that situation. He rightfully should have her back. But it could be that this is more of a power play. We don't know. We're just kind of looking at it between the lines. We don't know what the motivation is here exactly. If it's love or if it's power, don't know. Or if it's just the right thing to do. But he asks for her back, and that does happen. And her former husband weeps for her all the way almost back as before Abner turns him away in verse 16. And so, verse 17, Abner had a consultation with the elders of Israel, with the people of the north. Okay, he gets those guys together with the people of the north, saying, "In times past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. In the times past, you were ready for this to happen." He reminds them of where they were before, right? He says in verse 18, "Now then, do it," right? Yes, sir.
I found it was after this.
Okay.
It was when David retrieved the ark.
Yes. That's right, yeah. He was acting a fool, quote unquote, in the street.
It was after this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know, no commentary there. We'll come in on that later. The situation in this case, as Abner's making this plea to the people and of the north, saying, "We need to do this." You know, it's kind of the Nike slogan, "Just do it." You know, just do it already. Get back together with, make David the king. You were ready to do this before. And he mentions, he says, "For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. And so he's making this plea, Abner's making this plea to the men of the north, saying, you already had the heart, you already wanted for him to be your king, and it's going to be a good thing that he's your king, because why? Because God's going to use this guy to get those Philistines out of our lives and anybody else who's our enemy. Now, they've had problems with the Philistines for a long time. It's just, you know, they've been there, they've been a thorn in their side for a long time. It would be good for them to be kind of be done with that issue. And so he's reminding them that God said, David's the guy that's going to make that happen. David's the guy that's going to make the Philistines really no longer be an issue for us. And so, in verse 19, Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. And in addition, Abner went to speak in the hearing of David and Hebron. Now, remember, Saul's family is from what tribe? Benjamin. So he's talking to Saul's family here. He's saying these things to Saul's family. We need to do this. We need to do this. We need to do this. And so he also goes to Hebron, as we mentioned earlier, where David is, and he says the same thing there. And it seemed good to Israel and to the whole house of Benjamin. At this time, the house of Benjamin is divided. Look over in First Chronicles chapter 12. First Chronicles gives us some more pieces to this puzzle, as it also chronicles a history of this time. 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verses 1 through 22. We're obviously not going to read this whole section, but just enough to kind of give you an idea of what's going on. Now, do you remember the city of Ziklag? Remember Ziklag? We're going to rewind a little bit and go back to 1 Samuel. Ziklag was the city that David received when he was with the Philistines in the Philistine area. That was his city. That was the one that got raided. That was the one where they had to go get everybody back. And so this marks a time, and he talks about those who were on David's side in Ziklag. So when David is in Ziklag, that year and a half, slowly people were coming out of Israel and coming to be with David, to be on his team, to fight on his side. And some of those people that came here in verses 1 and 2, he says, now these are the ones who came to David at Ziklag, while he was still restricted because of Saul, the son of Kish. And they were among the mighty men who helped him in war. They were equipped with bows, using both the right and the left to sling stones and to shoot arrows from the bow. They were Saul's kinsmen from Benjamin. Now these guys were men of war. They were ambidextrous in killing people, which, you know, if you're going to kill people, that's a good trait to have. You can do, if you can sling a sling from both hands. Now, if they could sling a sling from both hands at the same time, now that's something. That would be something to see, right? So these guys were men of war, all right? And he goes on to mention the Gadites. He goes on to mention people from Judah, from Manasseh. And so various groups of people were coming down. He says in verse 22, for day by day men came to David to help him until there was a great army like the army of God. And so this Chronicles gives us information that while he was in Ziklag, people were coming to David and to kind of band up to fight with him and to be on his side. And so whenever we mention here that he mentions the whole house of Benjamin was in agreement with this, that's because there were already people in Hebron, already Benjamites in Hebron on David's side, and there were still people who were holding on to Saul's dynasty where they had made their capital. So that's why it's important to note that they were coming together in this situation. In 2 Samuel, back in chapter 2, we see that Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, gives us this information of where they were, and it mentions people who were on Ishbosheth's side. He made him king over Gilead, over Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, even over all Israel. And it talks about Judah being with the house of David. But it wasn't all of Benjamin. It was, again, this concept that they were divided peoples. And so this was very much a situation where the house, all of Israel was divided in relationship to where its allegiance was. Okay? So verse 20, the story continues. Abner had 20 men with him. So it's obviously he's not coming to fight against David when he goes to Hebron. He only has 20 men with him. And David made a feast for Abner and the men, and they were with him. And Abner said to David in verse 21, "Let me arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may be king over all your soul desires." And so David sent Abner away, and Abner went in peace. Again and again, Abner's trying to make peace. He comes as an emissary to David, talks to David, reassures him of their intent, and he says, "Now let me go back and get everybody, and we're all going to be on the same side, on the same team." Abner is very much this concept that we read about in Matthew 5, 9, blessed are the peacemakers, right? He is a peacemaker. He is trying to bring the house together. He's trying to bring everybody together on the same side. Now, as was mentioned earlier, there's some bad blood still. There's some bad blood. Verse 22, "And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with him. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. And when Joab and all the army that was with him had arrived, they told Joab." All right, special note here. They can get you in trouble, right? They can, this ominous group, they. Well, they say this. Have you had those conversations with people? Who is they? Who's they? Here, they told Joab, we don't know who they is, but they told Joab, saying, "Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he has gone in peace." Why would they do that? Why would they're going to stir up trouble, right? You're stirring up trouble. And there's always going to be they that stir up trouble. It is not necessarily in our power to stop that, but it is in our power to not respond in a way that they would want us to. And so they, in this situation, stir up trouble. "And Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he was sent, and they sent him away," is what they tell him, "and he's gone in peace. And Joab came to the king and said, 'What have you done?'" This is like classic movie situation, right? Classic. He comes, you imagine a throne room, you imagine where David is, and he comes busting in there. "What have you done? You sent my enemy away," right? And so this is kind of what is unfolding here. But Joab says, "Abner the son of Ner came to the king," fast forward, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you, and when they have sent him away, and he is already gone, you know Abner the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you and to learn of your going out and coming in to find out all that you're doing." What is he guising his vengeance or his anger as? What is he hiding it under? He's pretending to care about David. He's pretending to think that, well, Abner's a spy. Abner just is going to, he's going to lie. He's going to overthrow us. You need to take care of him, right? That's what he's hiding this under. And saying this to the, responding this way to the king. And so Joab leaves. Joab goes out from David in verse 26. And he sends messengers after Abner and they bring him back. He only has 20 men. It's not like he can like fight against the messengers. We don't know how many he sent. They came back. David, I think important note here, David did not know what was going on. Abner was the commander of the army. So he's a lot of leeway to do things that David doesn't know what's happening. It's easy for Joab to send an emissary out and bring these guys back to him without David knowing about it. And so then Abner returned from Hebron. Joab took him aside to the middle of the gate to speak to him privately. Be kind of cautious if your enemy wants to speak to you privately. Just throwing that out there. If you guys have enemies, I don't know what's going on. If you guys have mortal enemies, be careful if they want to speak to you privately, right? They do not turn your back on them, right? Do not turn your back on them. Don't lower your guard. And record the conversation if you need to. You never know what's going to happen, right? You never know what's going to happen. So in this situation, it would have gone well for Abner to heed this discussion. And so they took him aside privately and he struck him in the belly. I think in the King James it actually says like in the fifth rib. So he struck him and he died on account of the blood, on the blood of Ashiel, his brother, right? And so now we know really why he's dying. The text tells us really why he's dying. It wasn't that he thought he was a spy and he was protecting him and it's good for national security, right? National security. We're doing this for national security. No, that wasn't it. It was just plain old, everyday, common vengeance, right? That's what it was. Just common vengeance. Afterward, when David heard it, he said, "I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and all his father's house. May there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge or who is a leper or who takes hold of a staff or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread." So what is David saying here?
He did it without any consent.
Did it without any consent of me. And then he gives this like curse upon the family of Joab, right? So here's a curse of you're going to be Levitically unclean. You're going to have people that are unhealthy, that are poor. That's going to be your family. And that's what he's saying in relationship to Joab. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in battle at Gibeon. And so here we see the real reason why. It wasn't for the good of the kingdom. It was because of what happened at Gibeon. And then in this situation, they begin to mourn Abner. And you see that David is very much a man who is about justice. What is right? And this was, it was wrong to do this to Abner. Abner was trying to make peace. He'd been a bad guy in the past, maybe, but he's trying to make peace. We're trying to bring the house together. And they do this thing. And so then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth and lament before Abner." And the King David walked before the litter that was carrying the body of Abner. And thus they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept in the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. So this was a great lament. We even have a lament recorded here for Abner. And so we see David and what he's doing in relationship to the people. And all the people wept over him. Apparently David was fasting, because in verse 35 the people try to get him to eat, and he said, "I'm not going to eat until the day is done." And then verse 36, "Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people." Again, everybody loves David, right? David's doing the right things. He's doing the things that are just, that are right. And in this situation, he's proving that, one, he had nothing to do with this conspiracy, and that, two, that he cared really about what Abner was going on. And the people like his sincerity, and all of Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king that Abner died. And David said, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel?" And then David says, "May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deed." David basically said, "I'm too tired to deal with the judgment of these men. May the Lord deal with them as they have dealt with Abner." So that closes chapter 3. And as Abner's trying to bring everybody together, he's killed, and that conspiracy unfolds. And now we have another death in chapter 4, the death of Ishbosheth, the king of Israel. It's very short chapter. And now when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard, verse 1 of chapter 4, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage. Now remember what's happening with this house of David, what's happening with the house of Saul. The house of David goes up as the house of Saul goes down. There's a song like that, right? Blessings will come. Okay, so the house of David is going up and the house of Saul is going down. And now your commander-in-chief, the guy who was raising in power and everybody respected, the commander of the army, he's dead. And so are you going to lose courage? Probably. So he had gone to make peace and he had died. And all Israel was disturbed. Saul's son had two men who were commanders of bands. Okay, this is Ishbosheth. Had two commanders. The name of the one was Baanah, and the other was Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, the Bearite of the sons of Benjamin. All right, here's another note. For Beeroth is also considered part of Benjamin, and the Beerothites fled to Gideon and have been aliens there until that day. Now, you probably, and I didn't, I kind of looked this up to remember what was going on. Whenever they came into to conquer the land, in Joshua chapter 9, The kings of that land knew that they were coming in to conquer them. They knew what the people of God had done to Jericho. They knew what they had done to the city of Ai. And so they began to take different approaches to how they were going to deal with this invasion. All right. Now you have two options. You can fight against them, which apparently wasn't working, or you can try and trick them. And so there was a group of people who tried to trick the people of Israel. Do you remember what they did in Joshua chapter 9? So they were coming in, and they decided, well, let's all dress in really old clothes, let's have really old wineskin, let's have dried out moldy bread, let's look like we've been traveling, and that we too have come to this land. We're not from here. We don't have any fight. We have no dog in this hunt, is basically what they're trying to say. We have no part in what's going on here. We just kind of wandered in. We're at the wrong place at the wrong time, is basically what they say to Joshua. And they say, don't kill us. And Joshua makes a covenant with them without, the text says, without consulting the Lord. They should have consulted the Lord. God would have told them, no, liar, liar, pants on fire. But they made this covenant with them. They say, we'll never kill you. We'll never do that, those bad things to you. And then 3 days later, they find out that, oh, hey, you guys are from here. Like, you're just like around the block, around the corner. They found their cities. And at that point, it's like, you made the covenant. You can't touch us. Okay, so they made that covenant. But at the end of that chapter, Joshua says they make them to be the people who gather wood, who cut wood, who do all the manual labor and that kind of stuff. And so they kind of, you know, become slaves, basically. And they settle in the area that Benjamites had. And over time, obviously, they kind of just mold into one group of people. And that's where these groups of people come from. And so these two guys basically are not Israelites. They are just, you know, some Johnny-come-latelys on this scene. And they're descendants, rather. And so that gives you the background of who these two individuals are. Why they decide to give us that background is probably because of about what they're about to do. But they give us that background about who these people are. Verse 4 of chapter 4 gives us another section of foreshadowing. We have another son is named. Now, Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened that in their hurry to flee, she fell, and he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, y'all try and read these in front of people. It's hard. Okay, so Mephibosheth is a foreshadowing. Remember that name? We're gonna talk about that guy later on in 2 Samuel. But he had a nanny, basically, that was trying to leave so fast that she fell and broke his feet and he couldn't walk. That's, you know, bad news bears for him. But in this situation, we're given this little bit of information about him. We don't even know why contextually why this is here, but we're given this information. We're introduced to this character, and the story moves on. So the sons of Rimmon, this guy, the Berites, again, they're named in verse 5, they depart and come to the house of Ishbosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking a midday rest. So the siesta, midday rest. It's biblical. We should do it, right? Okay. So here he is resting, and they come in as though they were getting grain or they're getting bread, and they come in and we get like two versions here. We get the Cliff Notes version and then we get the detailed version about what happened. Verse 6 says they came in the middle of the house as if they were getting wheat, and they struck him in the belly, and Rechab and Banana and his brother his brother escaped, and they left. Banana. So they left, right? That's the Cliff Notes version. And then you slow it down in verse 7, tells us what they did. They came into the house as he was laying on his bed. They struck him, and they killed him, and they beheaded him, and they took his head, and they traveled away by the way of Arabah. This is what we talked about earlier, that desert, not a fun place to be area, north of the Dead Sea. They traveled through that to get away, which if you drew a line from that city, to Hebron, it's like as straight a line as you can get, traveling through that area. It would have been more convenient to go around and kind of travel the normal roads, but they went beeline to Hebron, okay, to where David was. And so they go, and then verse 8, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to King, behold, that's what you do when you're about to pronounce yourself, right? "Behold, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord, the king, vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants." They don't know, right? They don't know. First of all, they're already kind of coming together, right? The two groups were already starting to come together. And then they go and do this thing. They also don't know how David feels about this. What happened to the last guy that he thought was doing David a favor? He died. Remember, he said, "Why would you kill God's anointed?" He even lied about doing it. He really didn't do it, and he lied about it. So David answers. David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, and "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress when one told me, saying, 'Behold, Saul is dead.'" Okay, so he's remembering that and thought he was bringing good news. He thought he was bringing good news. "Saul, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And so David commanded the young men, and they killed him. All right.
Crazy there with the mic.
So if you kill somebody and you think you're doing somebody a favor, like, I don't recommend killing anybody, but if you thought you were going to kill somebody and do somebody a favor, and you've come in and announced yourself, "Behold, I've done this great thing for you. I've rescued you." And David said, "Actually, no, you're going to die." Do you think you probably went from here to here, maybe? Like, you thought you were some big guy, you thought you were important, and all of a sudden you're like this big and you're about to die. That's probably not a good thing, right? Probably a bad day. You thought you were doing such a good thing. And so they killed them. And David commanded the young men, and they killed them. And they cut off their hands and feet and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. Now, I don't know. Okay, how do you read this? Let me just take a vote. How many of you think they hung their bodies up? Any hands? How many of you think they hung their feet and hands up? Some of you are undecided. I'll let you be undecided. We don't know exactly. The text isn't like 100% clear on the them and what was hanging. We can probably surmise it is more likely that it was probably their hands and feet because they were not allowed to hang a body. Levitically, they weren't allowed to hang a body on display for more than a day. So you couldn't do that. So it is possible that they hung just their hands and feet, which if you read Proverbs chapter 6, verses 17 and 18, which you don't have time for, and Psalm 119, verse 101, hands that shed innocent blood, feet that run to wickedness, maybe that is a sign to what we're dealing with here. Well, the head was the head of Ishbosheth. What do you do with a head? I mean, you guys probably have never had to have that problem or deal with that. But they bury the head of Ishbosheth with the body of Abner. So they don't have Ishbosheth's body, right? But they have a relative. And so they bury the head with the relative there in Hebron, which shows that they have respect for Ishbosheth. They have respect for the house of Saul. They didn't just toss it in the garbage or something like that. And so that's how chapter 4 closes. And that dynasty, that lineage closes. The only one that we know left at this point is whom? Who's still left? Mephibosheth, right? The crippled. He will come in later on into the scene. We'll talk about him later in 2 Samuel. Any questions? Comments? Thank you very much for your time.